In China, the big worry isn't inflation, it's deflation, when prices are falling.
If companies or employers think prices are going to be falling, they feel they have to cut back somewhere else. And if they can't cut pay, then they cut employment.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also ahead, Hollywood's problems are rippling north of the border. Work in production houses in Vancouver, British Columbia, has come nearly to a standstill.
Last August, we had up to 55 active productions happening at one time. And here we are a year later with less than five.
Plus, we're down to the quarterfinals at the Women's World Cup.
Oh, here's a chance!
Eight teams still have a chance. We'll break it down. That's all ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler in for Marco Werman. Thanks for joining us. Authorities in Britain are taking a new and controversial approach toward immigration. They're starting to move small numbers of migrants onto a 300-foot barge docked off the southwest coast of England. It's a flat-bottomed boat used for freight, and the latest attempt by the Conservative Party to deter dangerous crossings of the English Channel. Since taking office last October, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has repeatedly said that reducing illegal migration is a top priority. Critics, though, say this latest move is unnecessarily cruel. The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Berry, is on the line with me. What's the point here, Orla, of moving migrants onto a barge rather than, say, finding a hotel for them?
Well, it's largely symbolic, isn't it? I mean, the government wants to be seen, as you say, to be getting tough on asylum seekers coming to the UK. So they've sent out this message saying that migrants arriving illegally into the UK, as they say, will be held either on barges off Britain, and this is the first time it's done so, or on military bases. I mean, on the first day that this group of asylum seekers were transferred to the barge in Portland Port, the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, who's actually on holidays in the US at the moment, he released this pretty dramatic video on social media listing the reasons why he's cracking down on illegal migration. Here's a snippet of it.
Third, I've increased raids by 50% to clamp down on illegal workers. Fourth, I'm ending the farce of illegal migrants being put up in hotels by the taxpayer.
So you can see the sort of tone he's trying to set here. In the video, there's images of police officers breaking down people's doors. That's the sort of banging sound that you hear. The second issue that the government says and that he's referring to is cost, because right now around 50,000 asylum seekers are being accommodated in government-funded hotels in Britain. And the government says it's spending the equivalent of $7.6 million a day housing the asylum seekers. So it says that the barge will save them money, although they haven't actually told us how much the barge will actually cost or how much money it thinks it might save.
So the barge is meant to be both a deterrent and a cost-saving measure.
Exactly.
I understand it can hold up to 500 people, but so far only about 15 or 20 are on board. Why so few so far?
Yeah, we do know about 20 people refused to go on board the vessel. That was because they had legal representation. One refugee charity, Care for Calais, said their own legal representatives managed to stop some of the transfers happening, saying some of the men, and it is all men who will be housed on this boat, that they're victims of torture or that they're disabled or they've already survived traumatic boat journeys and that this sort of accommodation would just be damaging for them. So they've managed to stop some of the transfers. One of the asylum seekers who's from Iran, who was on the barge this week, he posted a video from the bus before he got onto the boat on Monday, if you have a listen.
In حق ما نیست اینکه بخواید به خاطر جونمون از این کشور فرار کنیم و
And he's saying there, you know, honestly, we don't deserve this. We fled our own country because our lives were in danger. But now we're being taken to this place that's like Alcatraz prison. We don't deserve this. The boat itself, Carolyn, it does look a bit like a detention centre, I have to say, from the outside. And from the videos from inside the boat that I've seen, it is very cramped. It's very basic. And the UK's Fire Brigades Union has said that the boat is a potential death trap and it could be a massive fire hazard if the government insists on housing the 500 people that it says the boat can hold. But the government is saying we're going to plough ahead. They say more people will be moved to the boat later in the week and that will continue in the coming months.
The British Prime Minister says, as you mentioned, he's trying to discourage people from taking these small boats across the English Channel. Are there more people making that dangerous journey lately, Orla?
Actually, there are less people making the journey so far this year, but that might well change because, for example, around 46,000 people crossed the Channel on small boats last year, 2022. This year so far, it's actually been around 11,000. Now, that's about a 10% drop on the same time last year. But most boat crossings actually occur in the mid to late summer and autumn time. I mean, what many government critics are saying is this is all about winning back public support for the Conservative Party, because the reality is they're performing badly in the polls. They're trailing Labour, the main opposition party, by about 19 points. And they're using the issue of migration or illegal migration as a sort of a culture war issue to try and increase their support ahead of what's most likely going to be a general election sometime next year.
The World's Orla Berry, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Carolyn.
Governments around the world are struggling with how to accommodate incoming migrants. In Massachusetts, Governor Maura Healey this week declared a state of emergency as more people make their way from the U.S.-Mexico border to the Northeast. New York issued a similar declaration this spring. Shelters in Massachusetts are coming under increasing stress, and state officials and nonprofits say they are reaching a breaking point. GBH's Sarah Betancourt has this profile of one Colombian family now living in a Boston neighborhood waiting for asylum.
That's Adriana Caceres Torres telling her 7-year-old son Fredar that she's making him a meal. They live in a Dorchester apartment with her husband and daughter. 7 months ago, the Torres family was facing homelessness after arriving at Boston Logan International Airport with no fixed plans and little money. Her husband, Freddy Torres, said they were terrified.
The situation was very difficult. I was thinking to myself, why did I come? What did I do? What is happening? What about the children?
They fled their native Colombia, fearing persecution and economic instability as they struggled with their children's medical challenges. Larry Siemens, the president of Family Aid, the nonprofit providing state-sponsored housing for the Torreses, says families like theirs are currently overwhelming shelters, local hospitals, and soup kitchens.
I liken this to a natural disaster. I think everyone is rushing in to try to do their best with the resources that we have.
Siemens says there's not enough low-income housing for every family who needs it.
I do think this is probably one of the largest humanitarian crises that we've faced in recent times.
The Torres family sold their possessions, flew to Mexico, and paid a human smuggler to help them cross the border. They were briefly detained in Texas and released to pursue their political asylum claim. Days later, they were in Boston, knowing no one. Gladys Oliveros is a liaison for the city and remembers the family's confusion the day she met them.
Es bueno cuando yo les hablo.
It was good when I talked to them, and they immediately heard Spanish. Then they reacted and cried, and after those moments, we started to talk. After a few days in a city-sponsored hotel, Oliveros helped the family apply for the state emergency shelter program. They were accepted into housing and met a social worker there from shelter provider Family Aid Boston.
She told us not to worry. There wasn't that concern that tomorrow they're going to evict us. No, we could finally be at peace.
Social worker Paula Batista connected the family to health insurance, which came just in time for 14-year-old Sherry, who had a medical emergency.
I sent the family the next day to BMC, where they were able to register for the MassHealth. And especially that day, their daughter, because she's diabetic, she didn't have enough insulin.
With Batista's help, they enroll the children into school. They get free groceries from East Boston Soup Kitchen. The parents shoveled snow for work over the winter to help pay bills. Freddie got another overnight job packing fish at a company an hour away.
Como familia, es difícil.
As a family, it's hard. Much of the time, I don't see my wife. I typically get home between 5:30 to 6:30 in the morning, and she's already left to work at 6.
They can stay at home until their asylum case progresses. That's probably almost a year away, but they're grateful for the temporary stability. As the state grapples with a surge of new migrants, it's unlikely many families will have as smooth an arrival.
For The World, I'm Sarah Betancourt.
Vancouver, British Columbia, a.k.a. Hollywood North, has been a go-to filming location for American productions for decades. It offers important tax breaks and visually can sub in well for other cities. The film industry brings jobs and money to the region. So the writer's strike in Hollywood, which hits its 100th day today, and the actor's strike alongside it have had a big impact there. Gemma Martini is chair of the Motion Picture Production Industry Association in British Columbia, and she's also CEO of Martini Film Studios in Vancouver. Gemma, how is your film company doing right now? What's been the impact of the strikes for you personally as a business owner?
Well, we have 8 stages here on site, and we also have 2 off-site properties. But those 8 stages on site, only one of which right now is occupied. So we went through 6 years and we quite enjoyed 100% occupancy. But now here we are with 1 stage occupied with a smaller show. We're happy to have that show on site, but I know that there are many studios in town who have low occupancy like I do as well.
And citywide in Vancouver, how many films and TV shows would typically be in production right now, and how many actually are?
Last August, we had up to 55 active productions happening at one time. And so that's really maxing out all the crew that we have. And here we are a year later with less than 5. So there's very few of our 88,000 people in our industry working right now.
Wow. So only 1 in 10 of the usual level.
Yes. And those that we have are typically tend to be smaller productions because those will be the Canadian content. Those productions that we generally get for the American studios are generally larger productions, which of course then use more crew.
So are all of the productions currently ongoing right now all Canadian, or do any of them come from other foreign producers outside of the U.S.?
So the ones that we have happening now are the Canadian content productions. There's one production in town that has a waiver from the SAG union, so they can still use an American actor. But aside from that, there are only our Canadian content productions that are active.
You mentioned 88,000 people employed in this industry. How much money did the film business bring into British Columbia?
Generally, it's about $3.6 billion per year. So we're definitely much lower than that. And I'm curious to see at the end of the year how much it's impacted us. Of course, depending on how quickly we get back to work after this is over, it might be able to recover somewhat. But we're definitely feeling it. And we know that the numbers will be substantially lower.
So obviously, there are a lot of negative impacts on the local industry. But are Canadians in the film business in Vancouver still supporting the writer's strike and actor's strike in the U.S. or not so much?
Those issues that are being discussed at the table are challenges that are going to happen with the Canadian writers and the Canadian actors when it comes time to negotiate those agreements. So everyone's definitely standing in solidarity, but also feeling the desperation of not working. So it's a bit of a challenging juxtaposition.
Sure. Has there been any silver lining to the strikes for Canada? For example, you know, more of an interest or investment in Canadian films or TV shows?
I think that will have to come. What I'm anticipating is that there will be a demand for content once this is over. So perhaps those who have any independent films that they've filmed in Canada that have on the shelf, perhaps they'll be in a better position to be able to distribute or to sell them. Aside from that, we have not necessarily experienced a big bump in what we call the Canadian content production. It is a very small portion of what we do here in BC, less than 10%, but we are happy to have that work as much as we can get.
What kind of films does your studio make?
Our studio has been primarily television series. Vancouver does a lot of television series. We have a few feature films in town. You know, we've hosted productions as large as Snowpiercer and Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, right down to smaller productions that come in for a couple of months and move on.
What are some of the more famous American films that have been made in Vancouver that we might recognize?
Well, Deadpool, for sure, is a big one. We appreciate Ryan Reynolds bringing his first 2 Deadpools here to Vancouver. Currently, we have The Last of Us at HBO production, which was in pre-production up until recently in anticipation of being filmed next year. And we've hosted Warner Brothers productions here for decades. You know, Supernatural was here, I think, with 17 seasons. Flash for multiple seasons. Riverdale just wrapped up their final season. So we've been very fortunate to host a lot of really big productions here in BC.
Gemma Martini is chair of the Motion Picture Production Industry Association in British Columbia, and she's also CEO of Martini Film Studios in Vancouver. Thanks for taking the time, Gemma.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. It's been 2 weeks since a coup in Niger ousted President Mohamed Bazoum. He's been held captive in his residence ever since, without electricity and dwindling supplies of food. Bazoum has long been a close ally of Washington. Ironically, one of Niger's coup leaders has also been a longtime partner of the U.S. military. Brigadier General Moussa Salou Barmou was Washington's point person in Niger. For more on who General Barmou is and why he seems to have abandoned his U.S. allies, we reached out to retired U.S. Air Force Major General Mark Hicks. He headed U.S. Special Operations Forces in Africa from 2017 to 2019, and he knows General Barmou well. General Hicks, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So tell us a bit about Brigadier General Barmou. What sort of a relationship has he had over the decades with the U.S. military and the government?
Well, General Barmou has been the special operations commander for the Nigerian military and had received quite a bit of training, including the National War College in the U.S. He's been a partner, really a partner of choice with U.S. Special Operations Forces for many years and has been a close ally in the efforts to combat the Salafi jihadist insurgency. He was certainly one of the leading beneficiaries of U.S. training and education, and certainly his participation in this coup is not going to help our efforts to partner with foreign militaries.
The U.S. Special Operations Forces, commonly known as the Green Berets, right? So did General Barmou's fighters work alongside them?
They did. His forces were trained by our forces, primarily U.S. Special Forces, the Green Berets, and as much as we could, we partnered with their forces.
So from fighting alongside U.S. forces to leading a coup in Niger, how do you try to make sense of his change in mindset or why he pivoted?
Frankly, I'm struggling to understand what's happening. Obviously, it's disturbing and disappointing to see him participating in anti-democratic activities. That seems very out of character. He was a friend of the West, the U.S. in particular. This is a terrible disaster for Niger and for the Sahel in general. I can't understand what has motivated this coup at all. So I frankly struggle to make sense with what's happening.
General Barmou sat down in Niamey, Niger's capital, for 2 hours on Monday with Victoria Nuland, who's the acting U.S. Deputy Secretary of State. Do you know how that conversation went?
I think the reports of it being frank and difficult are about all I've seen, so that doesn't suggest that they made any progress. And, you know, he's an influential speaker and a thoughtful individual. I'm not surprised that he's the individual that is speaking for the junta because he is well-spoken.
And frank and difficult from a diplomatic readout is saying a lot.
Yes.
I understand that you were a close personal friend of General Barmou's. Can you tell me a bit more about your relationship?
Among the African leaders I dealt with, he was probably the most charismatic and aware of what was at stake in this insurgency that is continuing to grow in the Sahel. I consider him a very intelligent man and a thoughtful man, which again makes it all the more confusing as to why he's part of this effort.
What do you think he'll do going forward?
I don't know. And while not optimistic, I'm hopeful that something other than the current state can prevail.
How is it for you as a retired officer with deep knowledge and experience in this region watching all of this unfold?
Well, it's disturbing and disappointing and very sad. The people of Niger celebrated their first democratic transition just 2 years ago. And I guess this is the fifth coup since independence. And I think they deserve better.
Retired U.S. Air Force Major General Mark Hicks headed U.S. Special Operations Forces in Africa from 2017 to 2019. He's been telling us about one of the leaders of the coup in Niger. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
More fans are packing the stands at the Women's World Cup than ever before. Organizers in Australia and New Zealand say they've sold 1.7 million tickets so far. And that number is only increasing as the number of teams left decreases. The world's Bianca Hillier has the details on who's left and what to watch for in the quarterfinals.
This week, the host country finally saw their star player step on the pitch.
And now we're going to see Sam Kerr make her first appearance in this World Cup.
Australia's Sam Kerr sat out the first few matches due to a calf injury, so the crowd welcomed her with a huge applause. But just about 10 minutes later, a nervous hush fell over the stadium.
Kerr just went down.
Kerr seemed to slip on the grass and throw her head back in pain before getting up and finishing the game. Coach Tony Gustafsson says it was a tense moment watching from the sidelines.
I got very nervous, then straight away communicated with, how are you doing? You need to come off. You're good. She wanted to stay on, so hopefully that means she's okay, but I don't want to jump to any conclusions here. I want to respect the process. We check in on her and see how she feels and get my experts around me once again and do a review.
Kerr or no Kerr, on Saturday, the Matildas will take on France, who easily earned a spot in the quarterfinals. They scored early and often to beat Morocco 4-0. Spain also made it look easy when they sailed past Switzerland.
Back into the middle, and that is the goal! It's Bonmati who cleans up the chaos!
Midfielder Aitana Bonmati first found the back of the net in the 5th minute. The team ended up winning 5-1. When Spain plays the Netherlands tomorrow night, keep your eye on Bonmati, number 6 on the field. Some consider her the best player of the tournament so far, and she'll be looking to cement that reputation. She's got tough competition, though, including from the top scorer so far, Japan's Hinata Miyazawa. Miyazawa says, of course, she wants to keep that scoring record and win the World Cup's Golden Boot Award. But what she's concentrating on first is helping her team succeed. Japan is the only World Cup champion left standing. They won in 2011, and they've been playing so well, it looks like they could take the trophy again. Another team to watch out for is Colombia. Catalina Uzme scored a brilliant goal past 2 Jamaican players to advance her team to the quarterfinals for the first time.
Como les digo, vinimos a jugar 7 finales. Tenemos la certeza absoluta del trabajo que hemos hecho, de cómo nos hemos preparado.
After the match, Uzme said her team came to the World Cup ready to make it to the end. They're dreaming very big, she added, but she knows they have the soccer skills and mental strength to make it happen. Colombia, the last team standing from the Americas, will take the field next on Saturday in a matchup against England. They're ranked 4th in the world, far higher than Colombia, ranked 25th, but the UK squad will be without their MVP, Lauren James. Late in England's last game, James received a red card after stepping on Nigerian player Michelle Alozie. According to FIFA, a red card means James will be out for at least 1 match, but the ban could be extended by a disciplinary committee. On social media, James later apologized to Alozie, who wasn't injured by the incident. Alozie said she knows the game is full of passion and emotions, and she has nothing but respect for James. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
You're listening to The World. In the waters off Peru, some fishing boats are chasing a lucrative but illegal catch. The boats mask their identities.
Oftentimes, vessels also will change names and registries.
Then go a step further.
Turning off the transponders systems.
All in pursuit of one catch, sharks. The illegal trade in shark fins, ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. While many parts of the world are seeing rapid inflation recently, China's economy is going in the opposite direction. Deflation is hitting hard there right now. As the world's second largest economy, that's likely to have ripple effects far beyond China. To understand all this better, we're turning to Adam Posen. He's the president of the Peterson Institute for International Economics think tank in Washington, D.C. Adam, we hear a lot more about inflation these days. Remind us exactly what deflation is and what it looks like.
It's basically the opposite of inflation, but it's much more rare. It's when prices on a general basis across an economy are falling on average. It's usually associated with periods of very weak demand or great insecurity in the parts of people, and occasionally with financial problems.
Okay, so what's driving deflation in China's economy right now?
China, you'll remember, Carolyn, had very draconian lockdown policies and zero COVID. And so we all expected, to varying degrees, although I was an outlier, that China would bounce back like the US and Europe and UK did once they reopened. And that hasn't happened. And so that general malaise or insecurity, in my view, is pushing down on demand. There's also other issues that you've covered on the world and others have covered, that they are coping with the aftermath of a burst bubble in real estate in parts of the country. And there's an awful lot of young people, including especially young people with university educations, who are unemployed. So all of those things tend to drag down confidence, tend to drag down demand, and ultimately drag down prices.
So on its face, lower prices sounds like perhaps a good thing for consumers, the everyday person in China going to work and earning their paychecks and trying to pay their bills. But I imagine there are ripple effects that might be less good for the economy.
What really matters for people is relative prices in the sense of what's good. So you want your purchasing power to go up. Again, the flip side of inflation, people expect deflation. So therefore, they're more reluctant to spend because they figure the prices are going to fall and come down later. It also tends at the margin to contribute to unemployment because people don't like to take pay cuts. But if companies or employers think prices are going to be falling, they feel they have to cut back somewhere else. And if they can't cut pay, then they cut employment.
As I mentioned, a lot of other countries are dealing with inflation right now. We've been paying a lot of attention to the Fed's interest rate hikes here in the U.S. to try to keep that under control. Why is China dealing with the opposite problem right now?
Zero COVID was a turning point for China, that it shocked the average Chinese person that even if they were apolitical, the government could shut them down in their livelihood, could shut down a small business. I mean, always in theory, people knew that, but it made it really evident and in their face. And this reinforced trend since 2015 that President Xi and the party, the Communist Party, have been exerting much more direct intervention in the Chinese economy. And I think that combination has made people want to stay liquid and maximize their savings, particularly savings in like bank deposits, rather than buy durable goods, rather than invest in their small business. So that fear directly and indirectly pushes down on prices and pushes down on demand.
How is China's government responding to this right now?
The central bank is being asked to do things to counteract deflation, but with a balance that they don't want to create another property bubble or more financial insecurity, which is understandable. So they're doing subsidized mortgages, they're lowering interest rates in various areas, they're trying to encourage more borrowing. But at some point, you're pushing on a string. If people don't want investment, no matter how low you put it, and the interest rates, people don't respond. But my view is it's very hard for them to restore confidence when they were so interventionist over so much time.
Finally, I mentioned that China is the world's second biggest economy. What does deflation there mean for the rest of the world?
If China gets in a persistent deflationary situation, meaning more than a few months long, that will be a drag that will be felt elsewhere because it will probably mean further cutbacks in domestic demand, which will include further cutbacks in what they import from the rest of the world. It's not enormously important, as a number of people have rightly pointed out. Both the US and China are relatively closed economies. There are places in Latin America, in the Mideast, in Asia, Russia in particular, that are very dependent on trade with China. So if Chinese demand and imports go down, they'll hurt. But the direct effect on the US, Europe, Japan is not as large as it once would have been.
Adam Posen is the president of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He joined us from Washington. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me on The World.
Here's one item in China that doesn't seem to be losing any value. For centuries, shark fin has been a delicacy in Chinese cooking. It's a symbol of hospitality, status, and good fortune. The fin itself doesn't have a lot of taste, but it provides a gelatinous texture for a popular soup sold in fancy restaurants in China. People pay $200 or more for a single bowl. Tens of millions of sharks are killed every year to make the dish. And as the world's Tibisa Isaiah reports, the majority of them come from South American waters.
Venga, venga, aquí está el pescado.
At a fish market in northern Peru, fishermen and traders barter over mutilated sharks and load the fish onto motorbikes. Much of the shark meat will be eaten locally, but the removed fins are going elsewhere, China.
Más del 95% de las aletas se van a Hong Kong.
Alicia Kuroiwa is a biologist with Oceana, an organization devoted to ocean conservation. She says Peru is the largest exporter of shark fins in the world, and around 95% of their shipments go to Hong Kong. But the majority of these fins don't come from Peruvian waters, as Kuroiwa explains.
De las 400 toneladas que nosotros exportamos, 300 toneladas vinieron de Ecuador.
They come from neighboring Ecuador, where there are far larger populations of sharks and fewer regulations. César Ipenza is an environmental lawyer based in Peru.
Se han constituido organizaciones criminales que transportan aletas de...
He says there are criminal organizations that smuggle fins to Peru or hide them among frozen fish. And once in Peru, there is a system that allows for officials to issue illicit permits to ship them abroad.
Grupos perfectamente organizados que le dan un manto de legalidad.
He says the country is grappling with corrupt officials, a lack of capacity, and the large profits at play. In Hong Kong, a pound of shark fins can cost up to $700, compared to $7 in Peru. It's legal to sell shark fin in Hong Kong, but you need a special permit. People can face up to 10 years in jail for illegal trading. But prosecutions are rare. Around the world, it's not uncommon that shark hunters cut the fin off and throw the animal back into the sea, as seen in this video posted on TikTok. Unable to swim, they sink and die of blood loss or are eaten by other predators. This practice is known as finning, and it's banned in many countries. Alicia Kuroiwa says it doesn't happen so much in Ecuador or Peru, where sharks are caught and retained whole.
Porque nosotros comemos muchísima carne de tiburón.
Because we eat a lot of shark meat, she explains, so there is a market for that. But it is possible that foreign ships do engage in finning and get away with it.
Chinese-flagged vessels, you've seen them operating farther and farther off of coasts.
Evan Ellis is a Latin American research professor with the U.S. Army War College. He says China has pretty much depleted fish stocks closer to its own shores.
Their fishing fleets have had to go farther and farther away to find fishing stocks that have not been exhausted.
Recent investigations show that hundreds of Chinese fishing vessels are operating almost 24/7 off the coast of South America. In fact, last year, China accounted for about 80% of the fishing in the international waters off Ecuador, Peru, and Argentina. Evan Ellis says it's challenging for authorities there to catch illegal foreign ships.
Oftentimes, vessels also will change names and registries that make it difficult for them to do so. And of course, you have other practices such as turning off the transponders, systems that without advanced techniques make it difficult to prove that a specific vessel has been engaged in this practice.
The lucrative trade of fins is threatening species of sharks in South American waters, according to Maria Cristina Celi. She's a veterinarian and an environmental activist in Ecuador.
Tanto la pesca ilegal como la sobrepesca tienen efectos nocivos sobre los ecosistemas.
Celi says industrial fishing is depleting the overall fish population, which forces many local fishermen to look for exotic and more lucrative species, like sharks, or to go fishing in protected areas like the Galapagos Islands. The illegal shark fin trade is thriving in other places in South America as well. In June, Brazilian officials seized 29 tons, the world's largest ever shipment of illegal shark fins. Authorities estimate that close to 10,000 sharks were killed for this single shipment. For The World, I'm Tibisa Isaiah.
Chances are you did not win the massive Mega Millions jackpot last night. Sorry about that, but it was fun to imagine what you'd do with all that money, wasn't it? In India, there's a group of women who are living the dream, thanks to the lottery there. 11 women in the southern state of Kerala are sharing a $1.2 million lottery prize, won from a single ticket they all chipped in to buy. The women are all sanitation workers, earning wages that don't make ends meet, but they occasionally pool their rupees to buy one lottery ticket to share. The jackpot is a life-changing amount of money for them, but they told the BBC one thing won't change. They'll keep their jobs as sanitation workers, because that's what brought them the fortune in the first place. Costa Rica is known as a green paradise, but the Central American country is not immune to the impacts of climate change, including an increasing risk from storms and natural disasters. These changes are hitting some of the country's most iconic parks and reserves especially hard. Ecosystems there are rapidly changing. Michael Fox has the story from Costa Rica.
Okay, we ready?
Oh, yeah.
We do this?
Right?
Is that cool?
Yeah.
I'm doing it.
A couple of weeks ago, I went for a hike with my daughter up Costa Rica's Monteverde Cloud Forest Biological Preserve. It's one of the country's top ecological destinations, and there's a good reason for that. Lush green jungle, home to 2,000 species of plants and trees, 400 different types of birds, 1,200 amphibians and reptile species, which thrive in this unique ecosystem that is nearly permanently in the clouds. Or at least it used to be. See, as temperatures warm, the clouds are lifting. On the day we hiked up, it was abnormally windy and mostly dry. Decades ago, there were only 25 days a year where it didn't rain. Now, there are over 100 dry days a year. Monteverde resident scientist Alan Pounds has been at the reserve since the 1980s.
For a cloud forest, that's a lot of dry weather. Plants and animals in the cloud forest are adapted for this constant input of mist and cloud water. Like all these little orchids that grow on branch tips are have evolved to be bathed in moisture most of the time. And so they can be really affected by these kinds of events.
Already, two species of local frogs have gone extinct, the golden toad and the harlequin frog. And there are concerns that the extravagantly feathered quetzal bird, whose native mating habitat is in the cloud forest, may be in danger. Pounds wrote one of the first papers on the impact of climate change in tropical forests in the late 90s, and he says the future of the cloud forest itself is at risk.
If it continues on the present trajectory, I think it's safe to say the cloud forest is going to disappear. It's already turning into something else. It's turning into more of a seasonal rainforest.
Pound says the reserve might even get the total rainfall that it did before, but it'll come in clumps rather than dispersed evenly throughout the year. That transformation means a hit to the local ecosystem, with some species being pushed out or killed off, and others moving in as temperatures warm. Monteverde is just one of many places in Costa Rica that are seeing an impact. The privately run Tirimbina Biological Reserve is located about 100 miles east of Monteverde. Tirimbina boasts of having the longest suspension bridge in Costa Rica, nearly 1,000 feet across the rushing Sarapiquí River. And it's based in a tropical rainforest, not a cloud forest like Monteverde. But climate change is taking a similar toll.
Si usted hubiera venido aquí hace 20 años atrás, 25 años atrás,
Tirimbina biologist Sergio Villegas says if you came here 25 years ago, you'd find that more than 300 days out of the year, it was raining, constant rain. But not today. Daily rainfall has decreased dramatically. We took a night tour of Tirimbina.
In that area, we have also some steps. Walk slowly. Some things could be a little bit slippery.
It was a cloudless evening in the middle of what was supposed to be the rainy season. Villegas says there are studies that temperatures near the reserve have increased by almost half a degree over the last 20 years. For a person, that might not seem like much, but for a little frog or a fish or a sensitive species, that could mean the difference between a decline in the population or not, he says. Some species may move to higher regions, but others may have nowhere to go, and they may be condemned to extinction or to be highly endangered. Costa Rica as a country has been doing its best to stem the tide. Alonso Villalobos is a political scientist at the University of Costa Rica who specializes in climate and sustainability. Costa Rica has been one of the top Latin American countries on the forefront of the battle against global warming, he says. Combating climate change has been state policy going back over four administrations from the mid-2000s on. They've created national plans against global warming, pushed for carbon neutrality and transitioned to renewable energy. But even if Costa Rica continues to do its part, if other countries don't, climate change is still happening, and Costa Rica is still affected.
El cambio climático, sabemos que está. Sabemos que ya, o sea, no
As Team Bina biologist llegar, Sergio Villegas says, climate change is not something that's going to happen. It already is happening, and we're witnessing the consequences. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Monteverde, Costa Rica.
30 years ago, Sarajevo was a city mired in war. That conflict led to the breakup of Yugoslavia, changing the map of Europe forever. Today on Movement, our ongoing series focusing on music and migration, Maclit Hedero has the story of how the conflict changed the life of one artist.
Gino Jevđević, a.k.a. Gino, is an intense dude. He's got a bald head and a salt and pepper ZZ Top style beard so long that he sometimes ties it in a knot beneath his chin. Gino is from Sarajevo, and he's the founder and lead singer of the Seattle-based band Culture Shock, whose music brings together punk, metal, and Balkan folk. What's harder for me to picture is that before immigrating to the U.S., before the war in Bosnia, Gino was a pop musician. The way he describes it, most artists get less and less radical as they get older. His story is the opposite.
It's logical, you know? To be old and wise, you must first be young and stupid. I mean, I was a pop musician for the first, whatever, 10 years of my life.
Yes.
Yes, I sold the records, but I was miserable.
Really?
Yeah. I needed some art in my life because the music became way too commercial. It was a battle. And I got saved by the war. I think I'm a war profiteer in a very weird way, where I realize life is way too short to waste it on stuff that you don't believe in.
Right.
You know, I was at the end of the world. And I realized when it's up to disappearing, art will prevail.
In a village 2 miles south of Zvornik, we came upon the human calamity, which is the practical result of all this. 2,000 Muslims are stranded and struggling to get out. They spoke of the fighting.
I was living in my place, in my condo, and my mom's living across the bridge. So every single day, you know, you wake up. I don't have food at home. I go and linger on her food. And then one day, when I came to my mom's, the bridge closed.
That was the day the war became real for Gino. It changed everything, and he still thinks about what might have happened if he'd been stuck on the other side of that bridge.
I would not know you. You would not know me. I would not come to the United States. I would not make this band. This is circumstantial. So that day, April 2nd, I came to my mom's and then I stayed there for 3 years.
Wow.
Because my condo was on the front line.
Sarajevo was under siege for almost 4 years. Gino and the other artists he knew were trapped. And so they did what artists do.
I'm walking to the theater one day, and this father of my friend, he said, let's do something. Let's do a musical. And straightforward, I go, let's do Hair. And he's like, you're crazy, dude. This is an anti-war musical. Like, we're in the middle of the war. This is, well, let's do it the other way around. And by the way, let me tell you something. I'm not doing pop music anymore. He's like, what are you doing? You know, before the war, you could not push people in the theaters, like to pack the theaters with guns, right? We were packed for 3 years because there was no electricity, there was no running water, there was no nothing. There was just art. One day we're playing Let the Sun Shine In, da na 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 na. One woman jumped on stage and she starts singing with us. Like, why is woman jumping on stage and singing with us? But woman looks familiar. Who's the woman who's John Baez? Also, there's the guy who's hanging out on the stage and doing the video shoot. The guy was Phil Alden Robinson from the director and the writer of Field of Dreams. And then he went, had the drink with us and said, this is the best show I've ever seen in my life. I would love to have you guys in the United States. And of course, we can't get out. How can you get out?
The United Nations is still divided on how to stop Serbian aircraft violating the air exclusion zone over Bosnia. The
Americans want being trapped, being used as a pawn in the negotiations. I remember what I discovered then. I discovered that, you know, terror is a war of the poor man towards the rich man, and war is a terror of the rich man towards the poor man. But nothing really happened for her to come to the United States. And Phil is saying, okay, how about can you get out by yourself? I just went under the ground and I ran. And I got to Croatia and then after that, United States.
Can you tell me about how Culture Shock was founded?
So in that moment, I felt really homesick. You know, I'm a pop / rock musician. I don't do folk music much. I don't do ethnic music much. I know how to do it because my Roma background. And I started singing that thing just for myself. And we did it acoustically. But, you know, something was missing in that moment. Mm. It was great. There was a lot of people coming in. Everything was fine. It was very emotional. It was a little too emotional for me. There was still a lot of rage in me.
Yes.
And I needed to. I don't want to that rage to go out in my private life.
Yes.
So we plugged in. And I figured out you need to sing every single song like it's your last song or it doesn't count. So that's Culture Shock. Doing everything you have like it's your last thing, like you have 5 minutes. 5 minutes to sing. Sing. Sarajevo, čaršija, u reki Senjanica,
grbavica, željo, mama moja. That was Gino Jevđević speaking with Makrit Hedero for our series Movement. If you want to hear more stories about music and migration, including a longer cut of this story, search for Movement wherever you listen to podcasts. The series is produced by Ian Koss and Makrit Hedero. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Be good to each other out there and join us back here tomorrow.